Okay, so let's get back to Joseph. We've had a little side story about Judah. Remember, Joseph had been sold by his brothers. These traveling merchants now take him down to Egypt. It says they sold him to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. I'll point that out because later we're going to see another captain of the guard mentioned. And is it another one or the same one? Is there only one captain of the guard? Or is that a title that there might be several? I suspect that's the case, but we don't know for sure. But we know he was there. In verse 2 it says, the Lord was with Joseph. He was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw that the Lord was with him and made all he did to prosper. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. He, meaning Potiphar, made Joseph overseer of all his house. All that he had he put under his authority. From the time that he made him overseer of his house, so it was that all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian house for Joseph's sake. I'm in verse 5. I'm sort of running through this. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So this guy's doing great. Everything seems to be coming up roses since this Joseph guy showed up. Verse 6, he says, he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. He didn't even know what he had except for the bread which he ate. So when food shows up on his table, he knows he's got that. What this means is not that Potiphar is an ignoramus. It just means he trusts Joseph so much. So he has Joseph balance his checkbook. Joseph is paying the bills. He's bringing in the money. And I'm using modern phrases. I doubt that he had an actual checkbook. But, you know, Joseph is still a slave, but he becomes what sometimes they see the term steward, steward of the house. He's in charge of all of Potiphar's stuff. It's, you know, since we see God's influence here and his blessing, it seems likely that God might have worked things so that Potiphar was the one to purchase Joseph as a slave. And then he caused Potiphar to notice Joseph's aptitudes and his natural talents and give him more opportunity. So Joseph has a natural bent to work hard, to make good decisions, and there's prosperity results from that, aside from God's, you know, special blessings. We can keep in mind, though, that God has had a plan for Joseph all along. And later on, Joseph says it. He'll tell his brothers, you meant harm to me, but God meant it for good. So we could see that God, perhaps, through these experiences, is giving Joseph special training. As I said, he's learning how to balance a checkbook. Not a literal checkbook, but he's learning how to handle inventory, make decisions about giving job assignments and maybe hiring and firing people and doing all kinds of things. This is going to be important. You remember, Jesus later said, he who is faithful in little will be faithful in much, and he who is unfaithful in little will be unfaithful in much. Joseph is getting to run what seems like a big operation probably at the time, but is tiny compared to later running the whole of Egypt. But he's getting this good preparation. Okay, so anyways, this is going on, but there is a little problem. Verse 7, it came to pass after these things, his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, lie with me. I imagine this sexy, the sultry voice. And he refused. He said, look, my master doesn't know what's with me in the house. He's committed all that he has. There's no one greater than I, and he hasn't kept back anything from me except you because you're his wife. How then can I do this great sin or this great wickedness and sin against God? And so it was, she spoke to Joseph day by day, but he didn't heed her, to lie with her or to be with her. I wanted to run all that together, and I'm sure you've heard this story a number of times. You can't be a teenager in God's church and not hear the story as an example for what to do and what not to do, but it's worth us noting. One thing it's worth also, you know, we want to have in our mind a series of things that we can use to prove to people that think that God's law didn't exist before Mount Sinai, and that it was done away when Jesus was crucified. Here's an example of 200 years before God spoke the Ten Commandments, Joseph is saying that adultery was wickedness and sin. Okay, so how do we know it's a sin? God hadn't yet said, thou shalt not commit adultery, but of course, God's law is always there. I made a note here, Romans 5 and verse 13. Romans 5:13 says, sin is not imputed where there is no law. So if the law didn't exist yet, laying with Potiphar's wife wouldn't have been a sin. But Joseph says it's a sin, and I believe him because the law did exist. Anyways, we know all that. I think it's interesting. Joseph not only refused to have sex with her, but he said he didn't want to spend time with her. I can imagine Potiphar's wife saying, well, let's just hang out, let's talk. You know, let's drink a little wine, we'll pass the time. Joseph's like, uh-uh, I'm not going there. You know, we're not going to spend time together. And of course, then it comes to it. Later, he's going to practice what Paul would write in 1 Corinthians 6:18. 1 Corinthians 6:18, where he says, flee sexual immorality. Or the old King James says, flee fornication, which I remember because that was one of the jokes when I was a student of what is the smallest sin in the Bible, flee fornication, which, yeah, I'm glad somebody chuckled. It's really bad, but that's what Ambassador College students would do. Anyways, having said that, we'll get to the story. Where is it? Okay, in verse 11. About the time Joseph went into the house to do his work, none of the men were in the house. And so she's there. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left the garment and ran outside. So you can have that. It doesn't say that he was naked, per se, but you know, sometimes you imagine that. Maybe it was his outer cloak or something. She keeps that. And you know, they say there's nothing like the wrath of a woman scorned. You know, now, since she doesn't get him, she's going to make him suffer for it. So she called the men in the house and say, so she accuses him of trying to rape her. See this Hebrew? He brought us in to mock him, to mock it. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. When I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment and fled. So she's telling an out-and-out lie. But she's going to tell the lie again when Potiphar comes back. So it says he came back and said, the Hebrew servant which you brought to us came in to mock me. Verse 18, it happened, I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment with me and fled outside. So again, she lied to spitefully hurt him because she wouldn't give him what she wanted. And it's worth noting, if he did give her what she wanted, she might have got sick of him and done something similar anyways. We don't know that, but Joseph did the right thing. And like some of us sometimes, he does the right thing, and instead of getting this great blessing and reward right away, he's going to suffer. She lies, and Potiphar throws him in prison. In verse 19, his master heard the words saying the servant did this, his anger was aroused. Joseph's master took him and put him in a prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. The Lord was with Joseph, showed him mercy. He gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. So the keeper of the prison is soon doing what Potiphar did. He puts everything in Joseph's charge and didn't even pay attention to it because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. It's worth noting, prisons at that time were not used pretty much as punishment. Incarceration was not a common punishment. Rather, corporal punishment was. Basically, someone does something worthy of death, they'd kill him. If it was worthy of beating, they would beat him with rods or do whatever. What they normally would do is they would have a place to hold someone while an investigation was made or till there was a trial, and then the punishment would be given. So the imprisonment was usually just a temporary thing, not the punishment. What seems that happened is Joseph didn't get a trial. So he's there waiting his trial, and he never gets it. He's in legal limbo. And that's why this goes on and on. He's there, other prisoners come in and go out, and he's stuck there because proper legal procedure isn't being followed, which probably happened a lot more in Egypt than it does in the United States, but it still happens here. Yes, Julia?
I watched a movie. I watched a movie about Joseph. It was a while ago.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that they, I guess, kind of interpreted in the movie was Potiphar kind of had an idea that his wife was lying, but because she had spread it to the whole family, he had to take action because, you know, he didn't have any proof. So maybe he threw Joseph in prison because he didn't want to kill him. So he kind of left him there like, I'll keep you alive and I'll try to get you out of this.
I'm glad you brought that up because I had in mind to mention earlier and it slipped out of my mind, but that's not an uncommon interpretation that Potiphar might have suspected his wife. And so, yeah, he puts Joseph in prison, but he doesn't bring it to trial. He doesn't have him executed because maybe he's thinking, yeah, Joseph maybe is a good guy after all. So, yeah, we don't know that for certain, but it's that movie is not the only, you know, whoever produced that's not the only one to have that speculation. And I would not be surprised at all if that were true. As a matter of fact, I brought up the idea of the captain of the guard because, where do I have it here? Well, we'll come to it later, but later there's a captain of the guard, and remember Potiphar was captain of the guard. There's question of whether it's the same guy or a different person with that title. But at any rate, he's stuck in jail, and this seems to be a jail for people of high status, because later we'll see two of Pharaoh's servants there. And whether or not that's true, God again is with Joseph, and he's given favor. It's bad to be in jail, but at least he gets to be the head guy in jail. And perhaps he's learning some more lessons. He's learning, you know, more things that'll be useful when he's put in charge of running the country in Egypt. I made a note to put in my margin Proverbs 22, verse 29. Proverbs 22, 29 is where it says, "He who excels in his work will stand before kings." I don't know if Solomon was thinking of Joseph when he wrote that, or if that's one of the ones that somebody else wrote, but it's obviously true. It's Proverbs 22, verse 29. Joseph excelled in his work, and later he's going to stand before the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. And another thing we could see in this, because we know where Joseph's going to end up. You know, he's going to end up being the equivalent of prime minister of Egypt, the greatest country on the planet at the time. And God has that in mind for him, but he's not just giving him a comfy, posh education and one step at a time till he's up there. He's going through some difficult times, which, you know, we can look and say, well, maybe that's us in a lot of ways. When God has something good in mind for someone's future, which he certainly does for all of us, God has very, very good things in mind for every one of us in our future. But sometimes the way to get there is through great difficulties. Matter of fact, I've noted Acts 14, verse 22. In Acts 14, 22, it says, "We must through much tribulation enter the kingdom of God." So what Joseph went through, we could see similar to us, although fortunately none of us are in prison, and hopefully none of us will be. But when we go through difficulties, we could think, well, this might be part of the way of going to the kingdom of God. But anyways, as I said, Joseph doesn't lose heart. He doesn't lose faith. He's still working hard, serving diligently. So far, we haven't seen record of Joseph doing anything wrong. The worst he's done is not know when to shut up telling his brothers about these wonderful dreams he's having. And you can't call that doing something wrong, but it may be not having the best sense. Okay, we're going to move into chapter 40. It says, "It came to pass after these things." I'll note here before we move on, the total time that Joseph at this point has been gone from Canaan, we think was 11 years. We base that on later in chapter 41, verse 1 and verse 6. Matter of fact, because we know he'll be 30 when he goes in to see Pharaoh. Well, 41 verse 1 says at the end of 2 years. So 2 years after the preceding chapter is when Pharaoh has his dream. What? 46. So anyways, the point is, you know, out of this 11 years, we don't know how much of that time was in Potiphar's household and how much was in prison. Maybe equally divided, maybe not that much, but he'll have 2 more years in prison after the incident that we see. So anyways, he's there. He's been, you know, away from his family for 11 years. And it turns out the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt had offended their lord. He was angry, put him in prison. And so Joseph's in charge of them. Oh, here it is in verse 4. The captain of the guard charged Joseph with them. Back in chapter 39, verse 1, we saw that Potiphar was the captain of the guard. Either this is a different captain of the guard, or Potiphar was actually in charge of this prison, which might fit the idea that Potiphar wasn't so sure he trusted his wife and he put Joseph in prison, but he was able to show him favor there. Possibly. Leave it open. Like I said, there could be plenty more than one captain of the guard, but it's enough to make us wonder. So anyways, he's there, and of course, Joseph is in charge of these guys along with a lot of other things. Verse 5, the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, each of them had a dream one night. each man's dream with its own interpretation. We know later what the interpretations were. Joseph comes in the morning and look at them, and they were sad, or they were upset. It's like you could see it on their faces. What happened? He asked him, "Why do you look so sad today?" "Well, we each had a dream, and there's no interpreter of it." Joseph says, "Well, don't interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." These must have been some pretty vivid dreams, right? Oh, now I'm sorry. We have this thing in my household because my wife has vivid dreams all the time and remembers them. And she'll tell me, "I had this bizarre dream." A lot of times she'll wake up and says, "I was so mad at you. Yeah, because I did something bad in the dream." I say, "It wasn't me. I didn't." I had a vivid dream one night at the feast, though. And it's funny, it was a rough night with Connor waking up in the middle of the night, this or that. But the evening before, I'd been with a couple friends of mine. And basically, we were sitting around having a couple drinks talking. And one of them, his son, was staying the night with ours. We had three families where we traded off kids, sort of. Basically, like, we had one of the boys my son's age have a sleepover with us. And then two of the girls got together, have a sleepover, and two of the younger boys. So, anyways, I had this dream that it was about 4 in the morning, and the two guys I was hanging out with, another guy, show up at my house just drunk and being sloppy silly. And I said, "What are you guys doing? Have you been staying up all night drinking?" "Yeah." And these are very responsible guys who would never do that. And it's weird, of all the dreams to remember, I remember this one. And now that I'm thinking, it has absolutely nothing to do with Joseph or his story. Except to say that, you know, these guys remembered these dreams and they're really troubling them. It's like, wow, this dream must mean something. Why is Joseph so sure that he can give an interpretation of it? Well, for one thing, he knows if he does, it's coming from God. We wonder if Joseph had been interpreting dreams before. We know he had his own dreams and seemed, you know, everyone seemed to assume that those sheaves bowing down to his sheaf meant his brothers would bow down to him, and the stars bowing down to his star, and the sun and moon. So maybe God had given him the same gift like Daniel of interpreting dreams. Anyways, he seems pretty confident, so he says, "Tell me your dream." And so they do. The chief butler, "Oh, in my dream there was a vine, and the vine had three branches. It budded, shot forth, you know, basically flowers. They turn into grapes. I squeeze the grapes, and I've got wine in the cup, and I give it to Pharaoh." Wow. Now, I'll pause there because something that's kind of silly to point out, but, you know, there are some Christian religions that believe that drinking alcohol of any kind is a sin. And they point at this and say, see, they were drinking grape juice. Because if you squeeze grapes, you can't drink wine right away. So it had to be grape juice, and they'll try to use that to support the idea that everywhere in the Bible it says wine, it means grape juice. It's really a side point. And the counter to that is like, wait, the vine grew up, flowered, turned to grapes all in a matter of moments. The idea that you could squeeze them and get wine in a matter of moments fits the chronology of the dream, so it doesn't support any argument. And the point isn't about wine or grape juice. The point is about Pharaoh restoring the butler. And by the way, butler, the term butler is used, it could have been interpreted as cupbearer. Cupbearer to the king in ancient times was a very powerful position. Later on in the book of Nehemiah, we'll see that Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the emperor of Persia. Basically means you're the one giving him what he drinks and perhaps what he eats. You're in charge of making sure that he doesn't get poisoned. So to be a cupbearer means someone who's trusted. Trusted so much, you know, that you'll say, okay, I know it's not poison. Usually he'd have to drink it first, which is good because the king is buying the best wine, right? So you get to drink the best wine, only a little bit of it. I've heard people speculate that the cupbearer probably had a pet who would also taste the wine before the cupbearer did. I might be tempted to do that. Anyway, so this is more than just a butler. It's somebody with a high position and authority. And Joseph interprets the dream to say those three vines are 3 days, and in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to get you out of prison and give you back your job. Oh, that sounds great. And it sounds so great that the baker says, well, let me tell you my dream, right? I hope it has just as good a message. I was carrying these three baskets full of all kinds of baked goods, and birds came down and started eating them. What does that mean? Joseph, I wonder what Joseph, because it doesn't say it here, but I imagine Joseph going, well, the three baskets are 3 days, and in 3 days something's going to happen to you. But of course, it's not going to be good. Basically, Pharaoh's going to hang you. And it doesn't tell us what the baker's reaction was. I imagine he wasn't quite so happy. But the point is that both dreams would be, both interpretations would be fulfilled, exactly as Joseph said. In 3 days, the butler or cupbearer is given back his job. The baker is hung. Oh, but before, you know, after he interprets the dream, Joseph tells the butler something important. In verse 14, he says, "Remember me when it's well with you. Show kindness to me and mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this place. For I was stolen from the land of Hebrews." It's interesting, he says Hebrews. The Hebrews generally would refer to themselves as children of Israel, but it seems that outsiders often called them Hebrews. So Joseph is using the term that they would understand. "But I was stolen, and I haven't done anything that they should put me in the dungeon. So I'm in Egypt as a slave, and I didn't deserve that. Now I'm in prison, and I didn't do anything. Talk to Pharaoh for me. Get me a fair hearing." Remember, he's in legal limbo. He doesn't get a trial. Anyways, he does that before he tells the baker that he's at his end. And the fulfillment we see in verse 20. "It came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants, lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker. He restored the butler, and then he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted." Now, this is one of those places in the past we used to say, see, celebrating birthdays isn't good. Because Pharaoh is celebrating his birthday by hanging the baker. And that was a little bit of a stretch. We don't interpret it that way anymore. But just so you know, that's one of the reasons we used to give in the church to support why we didn't celebrate birthdays. It was kind of tangential. Yes, Kayla?
If maybe, okay, I don't get why they would be so sad.
Yeah, I think sad, and I didn't write down what the Hebrew word is. Dr. Britt, I don't know if you've got it open to... Because it doesn't necessarily mean sad, but it means upset or, yeah, confused and flummoxed or, you know, just bothered by it. Like, this is very vivid and it must mean something. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
So it's not like they dreamed that their dog died and they're really sad, but they're upset that they can't understand the meaning and they think it must mean something. Perplexed? Perplexed is probably better than flummoxed, although... Both of them have X's in them, so they're good words, right? And if you get an adjective with an X in it, it's fun to say. Okay, and in verse 23, "Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Okay, one of the things we often say is, did he really forget? More likely, it could have been interpreted, he forsook him. Because, face it, Joseph wants him to tell the Pharaoh, "Hey, while I was in prison, remember, because you were really mad at me and you were going to punish me, let me tell you about the guy I met." The butler is probably thinking, I'm going to leave sleeping dogs lie. I'm not going to bring up this prisoner to Pharaoh because I'm happy I'm not there. So he doesn't run to remind Pharaoh of, you know. So that seems more likely than that he really totally forgot. Although it is possible that he forgot. He was caught up in the excitement. Anyways, he's going to remember. And in chapter 41, we see 2 more years pass. So as I said, 2 more years, and we know from chapter verse 46 that Joseph is 30 years old. That's something. What a life Joseph's had. He was 17 when he was sold into slavery. So he spent 17 years with his family, 13 years either as a slave or a prisoner. He's had kind of a rough time in life. But now he's going to have a lot of years where things are going much better. Because Pharaoh had a dream. And this one, again, must have been a pretty vivid dream, so much so that it convinced Pharaoh that they must mean something. So he has 2 different dreams. And as you probably know, first he dreams of cows. Cows, 7 cows came up out of the river, and man, they look great. They're healthy and strong. Man, I'd love to eat one of those cows, at least the steaks off of them. But then 7 cows come up after them, and they swallow them whole. And those 7 cows that came after them were skinny and gaunt and sickly. I never seen such bad-looking cows in all of Egypt. And when they ate the big, healthy cows, they were still skinny. don't know how that works. And he awoke and, oh, it was a dream. And he falls back asleep and he dreams again. Now it says corn, or more modern translations say a stalk would come up and have seven kernels. Seven kernels of grain on one stalk, full and plump. You know, maybe you could get most of a loaf of bread off of just this one stalk. But then seven blighted, parched, you know, blown by the east wind kernels come up and they swallow those, and they're still blighted and thin. And Pharaoh wakes up and says, man, that was weird. But he's kind of upset thinking, okay, these were really vivid. What does this mean? It's got to mean something. Verse 80, he's troubled. You know, he's perplexed or sad. And he sent and called all the magicians of Egypt and its wise men. He told him his dreams. No one could interpret them for Pharaoh. Now the butler sees the time to not bring up him being in prison as a bad memory, but work it to his favor. And he phrases it very carefully. I remember my faults this day. Well, let me bring something up. When Pharaoh was angry with the servants and put me in the custody of the house of the captain of the guard, me and the chief baker, we each had a dream one night, each of us, and according to the interpretation of the dream. So we had a dream that meant something. And there was this Hebrew prisoner who was a servant of the captain of the guard, and he interpreted the dreams. And it came to pass just as he interpreted. You know, he gave me back my job and he hanged the baker. So Pharaoh's saying, wow, I got to talk to this guy. So he sent and called Joseph, this is verse 14, brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved and changed his clothing. I'll comment, you don't hear much about shaving in the Bible. Some have suggested that the Hebrew there could just mean he trimmed his beard, but other scholars studying Egyptology say that the Egyptians did have it was their style, they liked shaven faces. And so maybe, you know, I don't know if they had nice Gillette blades or something back then, but so one way or the other, Joseph cleaned up, you know, got new clothes, he fixed his beard or shaved it off altogether. So you got to look nice to go into Pharaoh. And now I lost my place here. Yeah, going back to verse 15. So he comes in and Pharaoh says to Joseph, I've had a dream. No one can interpret it, but I've heard it said of you that you can understand a dream. Joseph responds in the perfect way. It's not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. So I like that. Joseph is confident that there's an answer and that God will give it, but he's also humble enough to say, it's not me. We might have heard this somewhere before. Daniel says something very similar. When he's brought to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, there's a God in heaven that'll give an answer, not me. And this is a long chapter because Pharaoh describes the dream exactly as it's written down. So the dreams are the description of the dream is written twice in this chapter, and I'm not going to read it again. I didn't read it the first time. So, but in verse 25, after he hears it, Joseph says to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. In other words, they both have the same meaning. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven good heads are 7 years. As he said, the dreams are one. The seven thin and ugly cows are 7 years. The seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. Ooh. So this is the first time he mentions famine. He says, this is the thing which I've spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. And God is showing Pharaoh. It's interesting. God showed Nebuchadnezzar what what was going to happen, and then had a prophet come and give the interpretation. So there's something to be said for God working through rulers, people that he's put in position. Of course, for Joseph to tell him that is also a great stroke to Pharaoh's ego. Hey, the God of creation is talking to me. He's showing me what he's going to do. He didn't give anyone else this dream. But he also is going to give Joseph the chance to win a lot of favor by interpreting it. And it goes on from there. Basically, yeah, there's going to be 7 years of great plenty. The land is going to bring forth by the handfuls, it says. You know, the crops are going to be so good, you're going to have food just laying around, you don't know what to do with it all. It'd probably go to waste a lot of it. But after that, there's going to be 7 years of famine. If the famine is going to be so bad, people will have forgotten the years of plenty. And basically, probably because of drought. One thing that I'll mention is, you know, We see Egypt. You know, there's not a lot of rain now in this area and not much back then. So the agriculture in Egypt relies on annual flooding of the Nile. The rain way upstream, which is south, and the Nile would flood over its banks, which would put silt on the soil and sort of rejuvenate it, and they would run irrigation off of that. So that it was very reliable. Every year at a certain time, the Nile is going to flood, and that's how we grow our crops. If there's a drought further south, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, and the Nile doesn't flood, they can't irrigate, and there's going to be a famine. You know, they can't pray for rain because it doesn't rain there. And so how this worked is very easily understood. You know, why there wasn't a flood, I guess because God was controlling things. But now Joseph is not only going to interpret the dream, but offer a plan of action. In verse 33, "Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and a wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Appoint officers over all the land to collect one-fifth of the produce. Take up a tax of 20% of the crops and put it in storage during the seven plentiful years. And let them gather up in, all the food of the good years that are coming. Store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh. Keep the food in the cities. And that food will be a reserve for the 7 years of famine." Verse 37, "The advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and his servants." It's like, well, that makes perfect sense. We're going to have 7 years with so much food we don't know what to do with it. Let's take a percentage of it and store it so we're ready for the famine. And then Pharaoh makes a leap that might be, seem surprising to all of us. Because, you know, if someone brought that to me, I'd be thinking, yeah, who do I know somebody that's really qualified for that? Or I'd likely use one of my officers. But Pharaoh, and verse 38 says, "Well, can we find such a man in whom is the Spirit of God, such a man as this?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there's no one as discerning and wise as you. You'll be over my house." So what a turnaround. You know that what's going to happen. You know the plan. I'm putting you in charge. I wonder how Joseph felt at the time. And I've been put in charge suddenly of small projects that kind of stagger me. I got to do what? I still remember the first time I was told I was in charge of Winter Family Weekend. It's like, oh, I had no idea. Well, Mr. Antion did it, so now you're doing it. Okay, luckily there's a lot of well-qualified people who do all the work, and I don't have to. Joseph has a plan of nobody else knows what the plan is or how to do it. He's got to implement a lot of stuff, but he's had a lot of training. He was running Potiphar's household, then he's running the prison. He's in touch with God who will work miracles for him. So Pharaoh does this. Verse 40, "You will be over my house and over all my people, and all my people will be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I set you over the land of Egypt." And that's where we say he made him the equivalent of prime minister. So the top dog, second only to Pharaoh. Pharaoh took off his signet ring that was on his hand and put on Joseph's hand. So he has the authority to make official documents and seal it with Pharaoh's ring, which to us, I don't know, it sounds kind of hokey in modern parlance because we have all these official records and all that, but having that signet would bear the authority. Nobody else had that. And so Joseph has this, and he's given fancy clothes, he's given a chariot, they'll cry, bow the knee, and he puts him over all the land of Pharaoh, or all the land of Egypt. It's interesting, only an absolute monarch could quickly elevate a former slave to such a high position. You know, but Pharaoh was an absolute monarch. And there's indication that he would become a more absolute monarch. You remember that the documentary, Patterns of Evidence, one of the things that showed that during this time of famine, Pharaoh would gather, you know, basically gather the money and gain ownership of the land. So instead of having a lot of powerful nobles at the end of the famine, suddenly there's Pharaoh who has a tremendous power and everyone else is way below that. I'll mention another thing that I speculate on this, and this is just my speculation, but I've sometimes wondered if this particular Pharaoh might have been relatively young. You know, they inherit the throne, and we know from study of Egypt's archaeology that sometimes they would have boy pharaohs. You know, they come to the office young. If that were the case, I could see him being impetuous and maybe quick to trust someone who seems older and wiser. One of the reasons I think about this is later in chapter 47, when Pharaoh meets Jacob, what's the first thing he asks him? He said, "Dude, how old are you?" You know, he doesn't say it like that, but Joseph, you know, Pharaoh asks, "How old are you?" It's like he's never seen anybody that old, which is something a very young person might ask. But keep in mind, this is only Dunkel's personal speculation. It might not be that way. But he calls, in verse 45, Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah. Wow, what does that mean? We don't know what it means. Actually, the meaning is not clear. Some people say that it might mean revealer of secrets. That's kind of cool. I've read others say that it might mean savior of the land. And yet others say it might have just been the name of the title of the office that Joseph was given. I've been saying he was made the equivalent of prime minister, but his job title might have been Zaphnath-Paaneah. Although it says it called him his name, the Hebrew is vague enough to allow for that. But and he gave him a wife, Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. So Joseph hasn't had a chance to get married all this time. Well, all this time he's only 30, but still. It says the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On. The word that the Hebrew is Kohen, which is the word that's translated priest. But some have said, and I know that the, I think the margin of the Old King James says that might also be translated as prince. And the main reason we'd like it to be prince is because we don't like the idea of Joseph, this worshiper of the true God, marrying a pagan priest's daughter. But either way, it doesn't seem to, if she was, that didn't change Joseph. So whether he married the daughter of a prince or of a priest, either way, she was probably worshiping false gods before the marriage and hopefully changed and Joseph taught her the truth. I'm curious, I see Potipharah, which looks suspiciously similar to Potiphar, the guy who first owned Egypt. Could just be coincidence, because I've often thought, well, is it the same guy? And what an interesting irony. But you'd think it would go out of its way to tell us if something so ironic happened. Joseph ends up marrying the daughter of the guy who owned him as a slave. And since it doesn't say that, most people assume this is somebody different with just a similar sounding name, which makes it mostly pointless that I brought it up, but I thought I would anyways. Okay, so it's worth noting also, remember, who is Joseph? He's this nobody that was a slave. He's a Hebrew. So they marry him into a prominent family, and that builds his prestige and his acceptance among the ruling class. That's something that's been common throughout human history. Matter of fact, you can read it in, you know, medieval Europe and into the early modern period. It would be common for someone who gains wealth and influence to marry into the aristocracy to lend respectability to the wealth and position that they had. So this is done kind of for Joseph, and as I said, it helps him to get along perhaps better. Okay, so, and here in verse 46, as I said, Joseph was 30 years old, so that tells us, you know, he was basically back home with his family 17 years. The last 13 years have been a mixture of some pretty bizarre trials, and now suddenly he's running the country. And he doesn't have time to just relax and enjoy all this because the seven plentiful years start right then in verse 47. So he gathers up all the food of the 7 years. And get the idea that everybody's so having such good crops for Pharaoh to say, "Hey, you got to give me 20% of that." I said, "It's fine, I got plenty anyways." So there's no mention of people fussing or arguing about a 20% tax. And he gathers at verse 49, very much grain as the sand of the sea. He stopped counting. It was immeasurable. So that's something. Principal crop at that time, a lot of scholars think, was probably rice. Probably some other grains, but I believe rice is still grown in Egypt. And again, the crops must have been pretty big so that 20% would sustain the country for 7 years afterwards. Joseph is going to have two sons. Verse 50, two sons were born after the years of famine came. So we get in the 7 years of famine when he starts giving out the grain. Called the firstborn Manasseh, which means forgetful. God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. So everything that happened in the first 30 years of my life seems like a dream, like another life. So he names his son Manasseh. And we both, our interpretation of prophecy, the received prophetic scenario, as Mr. McNeely says, is that he's the progenitor of those who are mostly in America today. And then he'll have a second son, Ephraim, which means fruitful. And he said, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of affliction. Interesting, Ephraim and Manasseh seem to then have an Egyptian mother, which gives them the same ethnicity as Ishmael. Remember, Ishmael had an Egyptian mother, Hagar, and Abraham was his father. I'm not sure what the significance of that was, but it would make perhaps Joseph's children look a little bit different than those of his brothers, but we don't know if they didn't all marry Canaanites or what exactly. But our understanding is that Ephraim and Manasseh will become the forebearers of what we call the English-speaking peoples, you know, America and the British Commonwealth. And we'll see, and I'll bring it up here because Joseph has these two sons, and later Jacob will adopt them, and they'll be listed along with all of Joseph's brothers instead of Joseph. I mentioned Joseph is going to get the birthright. He'll literally get a double portion. He fathers two tribes of Israel, whereas all the other sons have one tribe. We'll get around to that a little later when Jacob makes it clear. But we go in, starting in verse 53, the 7 years of plenty ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come. And the famine was in all the land, so not just Egypt, but they hear, hey, in Egypt, they got food. Because, of course, Joseph's policies provided them. So, verse 55, the land of Egypt was famished. The people cried out to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said, don't ask me, go to Joseph. Whatever he says, do. Famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And not only the Egyptians, verse 57 says all the countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine was severe. And I've got a note here, and I don't know the exact dig, but there's evidence archaeologists found an inscription in what is now Yemen. And Yemen is, I believe, over here, isn't it? That basically an inscription talking about going to Egypt to buy food from, you know, during this famine. So that would fit the biblical story. And that's a long ways to go. Yeah, all the way from, anyways, long ways to go to get bread. Okay, anyways, that inscription by itself doesn't prove all the story of the Bible, but it's interesting, as I said, as we discover things in archaeology, time and again they support the story of the Bible rather than disproving it. I don't want to go all the way into chapter 42, but we could at least introduce it fits. And actually, chapters 41 and 42 could have been one long chapter, along with chapter 43. It's this one continuous story. But we go back to Jacob and the clan, not the clan like in Ku Klux Klan, but I mean the family clan. They saw there's grain in Egypt. And I love this in 42 verse 1. Jacob says to his son, why do you sit there looking at one another? What are you sitting there looking at each other for? Go to Egypt and buy us some food so we can live and not die. Okay, so it's like, hey, don't sit here and act like dummies. Go get us some food. So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain. Now Joseph doesn't have 10 brothers. He has 11 brothers, remember? But verse 4, Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin. And Benjamin is his brother more than the others, right? Remember, they share the same mother as well as the same father. So there's a connection that becomes very important in this story. And why didn't Jacob send him? Lest some calamity befall him. Okay, so we'll make the point that Egypt is selling grain. It's known, and so people come. But it seems from what we'll see in the story, there's no guarantee or promise that just because you show up, you get to buy food. The Egyptians have it completely under their control. And now Joseph has shifted his job from being in charge of gathering up food. Now he's in charge of dispersing food, setting the price and all that. I wanted to mention this because we can see Joseph has a hands-on approach. In verse 46, Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people. This, you can almost get the idea that he's sitting in a 7-Eleven with a cash register, and people come in to buy food, and he's the one ringing it up. But come on, we're talking about a nation the size of Egypt. So he's administrator over a network, a bureaucracy to sell this grain. But he's got the final authority, and he is close enough to have a hand in dealing with people from other nations. And most of them are going to come from this direction. Some might come from over here, but why would they come from over there? Because the map stops, so there is no over there. Well, somebody might at least chuckle or smile at that. When the professor says something totally stupid and silly, no, there's not a lot of people. It's not a dense population, but there are quite a few people here. And there's some speculation, why is Joseph hanging out here? Maybe, knowing that people are coming from other countries to buy food, you suppose he's thinking, hey, maybe I'll catch sight of one of my brothers. Maybe he's hoping they'll show up. And I'm saying it's a big maybe. You know, I could read that into it, but we don't know for sure. But we know he is involved. And so he's overseeing things, and he can come down like from the office to the storefront, if you want to use that as an analogy, when he deems it proper. And that's exactly what's going to happen when he sees his brothers show up. And that's a story that we'll save for Wednesday.